You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Well, good afternoon, Greenbelt 2024. Welcome along to the no-fly zone. Has everyone had a fantastic afternoon so far? Fantastic. Now, a wee bit of intervention here. Has anyone been to anything at no-fly zone before? Oh, lots of hands. That's good. Is there anyone for whom this is the first time they've been to no-fly zone? I see a few more hands. It's good. A good sign that plenty of you have come back already, and I hope a lot of you will come back again if this is your first time. Now, this is the No-Fly Zone Christian Aid's presence at Greenbelt 2024. Now, Christian Aid, many of you will know, has been partnered with Greenbelt and Christian Aid have been partnered together for 31 years now, 31 years. But this is the first time ever we've done the No-Fly Zone. So if you think it's been a great success, which I hope many of you think it has, do let us know afterwards what you think. If there's any feedback or thoughts or things you'd like us to change or alter going forward, we'd love to hear your feedback, how we can keep building on it, how we can make sure everyone has the best possible experience of Greenbelt and the best possible experience of the no-fly zone. But for now, I am absolutely delighted to be introducing our next panel session. In just a second, I'm about to introduce Faith for the Climate, Dream On, where we're going to be exploring that theme of climate justice, how we can take things forward. And it's, I think, really leans into that spirit of what is Christian Aid all about? What is Greenbelt all about? And it's absolute pleasure to introduce our chair for today's session, Faith of the Climate, Giles Goddard. Giles.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all very, very much for coming. It's very good to see you all. I hope you're warm enough. And if not, at the end of this panel, you can go out for a quick run to warm up. So my name is Giles Goddard, as you just heard, and I am the chair of Faith for the Climate. I'm also the vicar of St. John's Church in Waterloo, the Anglican Church just opposite Waterloo Station. It's lovely to see some friends in the audience, familiar friends, and to see some new faces. So I set up, or we set up, Faith for the Climate about in 2014 in order to bring together people of different faiths to work on climate. It became apparent to me that there wasn't a space where faith traditions could work together to try to counteract the climate crisis. And so we made it happen. And we've been working ever since to build networks, to develop relationships, and to make people more aware of the urgency of the crisis which is facing us. And that's why it gives me great pleasure to be here. We've worked very closely with Christian Aid over many years. Greenbelt has focused on climate over even more years. And it's wonderful to bring together Faith for the Climate, Christian Aid, Greenbelt, and all of you to think about the challenges that we're facing and to think about how we can overcome them. And what's been very real today, I've noticed, is the focus on hope and the emphasis on hope. And I'm hoping that out of this session today, we will go away feeling encouraged about how we can make the world a better place and counteract the crisis that we're facing. So I'm really honored that we've got three really excellent participants in this panel. On my left, we have Shannon Shah, who is the director of Faith for the Climate, amongst many other things. And he is going to be, I think I'll just leave it there for now. Online, we have Rachel Mash. Rachel, lovely to see you. How are you? Thank you for joining us. Rachel is in South Africa. And Rachel, again, has an enormously long CV, but the reason that she's here is because she's the coordinator of the Anglican Communion Environmental Network. Lovely to have you with us, Rachel. And thank you for not flying here. It's part of the no-fly zone. And we also have Kamran Shahzad, who I've been working with, again, for many years. And Kamran is a grassroots environmental activist and social justice campaigner, mainly in Birmingham, and who's worked with a huge range of faith groups and is a really core part of the interfaith climate movement in this country. So what we're going to do is each of our speakers is going to make a short presentation. And then after that, I'm going to have a conversation between the three of them. And then we're going to open it up for questions. And we will aim to finish. We will finish by 5:30 at the latest. So let me come to you first, Shannon. And I wondered if you could paint the scene for us to kick off. So from Faith for the Climate's perspective, how are we seeing faith communities at the forefront of action on climate? And what are the challenges there for people of all faiths to get involved in this fight?
Yes, let's do that. And I thought maybe the best way to do it is by showing you, just telling you a story of Faith for the Climate's journey. Giles has already introduced how 10 years ago, I think it was exactly 10 years ago, there was this appetite. You know, Giles was noticing a gap in how climate was being addressed, and especially whether faith groups were able to tackle it and collaborate on climate action effectively. And one of the catalysts for this was the UN climate talks in Paris in 2015, COP21. And this was when a group of churches and Christian faith-based organizations came together to organize something called the Pilgrimage to Paris. And I think quite a few of you in the audience might know about this or might have even been on that pilgrimage. And you can see Giles there holding up one of the banners. And of course, Christian Aid was one of the key stakeholders that planned this. The good thing about this was it showed that there is a lot of willingness and ambition by faith groups to really want to address the climate crisis. Before this, there were lots of faith-based organizations that were talking about conservation, nature, environment. But I think this was one of the first times when, you know, the climate message really was the forefront of what was being done. But as you can see, it was mostly Christians represented here. The thing about this pilgrimage was there was interest from non-Christians to join as well. So I think there were one or two Buddhists who thought, can we join? And that's when Giles thought, there's actually room to think about faith in a bigger sense and what different faiths are doing or want to do to tackle the climate crisis. But of course, not all faith institutions and communities operate on a level playing field. So lots of minoritized religious communities, or, you know, even within mainstream religious denominations, minoritized communities do not have the same level of resources or capacity to do things, even though they have the ambition to do it. So one of the things that Faith for the Climate embarked on initially was a project to build the capacities of minority faith communities in the UK that wanted to take climate action. And this is when we started working more closely with Kamran, some of our Buddhist members, Hindu members, and Sikh members as well. And we got some seed funding to do this. And so then we experienced the growth spurt in 2019. And you can see the picture to your left, my right, which was the Time Is Now mass lobby of Parliament. This was the biggest in-person mass lobby of the UK Parliament at that point, specifically on climate. It was organized by the Climate Coalition. You can see the diverse faith leaders and representatives who came. And then in 2019, in some way, we were also involved through Giles's capacity as Vicar of St. John's, Waterloo, St. John's Church in Waterloo, London, where we supported the Extinction Rebellion actions in spring of 2019 and autumn of 2019. And there were lots of people of faith involved in those actions as well. And they eventually got interested in Faith for the Climate and signed up to the network as well. So these were two quite different types of action. One was nonviolent direct action, and the mass lobby was, you know, what it says on the tin. You go and you lobby your MPs. So that's when we realized that there's actually different ways that people want to take climate action as well. And that has informed how Faith for the Climate operates. It's for any person of faith at all, however you describe your own faith, wanting to take more ambitious action on the climate crisis in whatever way you want to, in whatever way that they want to. So it could be writing to your MP, meeting them. It could be nonviolent direct action and so on. Then the second growth spurt happened when the UK became host to the climate talks, the UN climate talks in 2021, COP26 in Glasgow. Now that we knew that there was an appetite for this network to grow and there were different faiths in the UK that were getting involved in this, it wasn't enough to say, right, this is a space for faith groups that want to take more action on the climate. What exactly are we saying? And because we operate as a network, we were taking soundings from different stakeholders, and it was Quakers in Britain who said, we really do need, as faith groups in the UK, to talk about the root causes of the climate crisis, which includes histories of colonialism, capitalism, extractivism, and so on. And we as faith groups in the UK, where COP is being held, have a special responsibility to hold the UK government to account for its historic role in causing the climate crisis through its actions as, you know, the British Empire and the role of colonial capitalism and so on. So we decided to focus on two messages for COP26, two key demands that related to this issue of root causes, which is basically a climate justice analysis, right? Because the climate crisis affects those who have done the least to cause it the most. And so those who have done the most to cause it have the biggest responsibility to do something about it. So we asked for an end to public subsidies for fossil fuels, and also for adequate and new finance for the irreversible losses and damages that are caused by climate breakdown in different parts of the world. And the work on loss and damage was quite historic. It became the issue that didn't go away at COP26. And we've continued doing that work. So these two growth spurts have sort of informed how we've evolved as a network. So we do take part in a lot of mass mobilizations, but we make sure that there's as much participation and representation as possible. So there was a good multi-faith block at the Restore Nature Now protest earlier this year. But actually, this sort of work is not our priority. So the priority really is in building climate justice within the network as well. So in the climate and nature movement in the UK, I think this is the second least diverse sector in the UK. Why is it the second least diverse sector in the UK? One is the way that we think about climate and environment. And this is where I said in a panel earlier, a justice-focused analysis is very important, because the climate crisis is not just a technical environmental thing that will get solved through scientific or technical fixes. It's a moral and political issue that will require moral and political solutions. And it affects different people differently. And so we try and link things like, what's the connection between racial injustice and climate injustice? And we don't just do this through turning up at protests, even though those are important. So for Black History Month, what we find more effective is having panel discussions, film screenings, that really draw the link between climate injustice and racial injustice. We do things during Interfaith Week as well, which in the UK often coincides with Diwali. And that's a really important way of bringing together other people in the network. So mostly Hindus, Sikhs, and Jains. And again, we try and do different sorts of events during Interfaith Week. And also things like picnics. So lots of people in the network have kids. They have families. And not all of them can afford to attend a nonviolent direct action. But they still want to do something on the climate. And they want to meet other people doing things. They want to be inspired by other people doing the same work. They want to learn from people of different backgrounds, which I think Kamran can talk more about and I can talk more about as well. So this year, we thought for the Great Big Green Week, why not organize an interfaith picnic at Giles's Church, where different faiths were represented. And I think the best... I'm going to finish in a minute. The best... testimonial I have from that picnic was when one of our Hindu members, who is the National Coordinator for Hindu Climate Action, so we started this picnic last year and did it again this year, and we did it because he has a son, Adi, who is 5 this year, who had such a great time at the picnic last year, went back last year and said, when are we doing this again? And we thought, we have to do this for Adi. And this year, as Adi left, he said, oh, well, I can't wait to come again next year. So Avnish, who is the coordinator of Hindu Climate Action, said, well, thank you for creating this space where I don't feel like I'm going mad as a parent who cares about the climate, and where I can bring my kids with me. And we're not just meeting other Hindus. We're meeting Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Jews, Sikhs, and so on. And that's the kind of space we try and create as well. Not just a space of hope, but a space of joy to do climate justice activism.
Thank you, Shannon, so much. It's really important to end on a note of joy, because sometimes these things can feel very challenging, can't they? And coming together in this way and giving us hope is really crucial. So thank you, Shannon, very much for that introduction. Rachel, are you there? I hope you're there. Yes, you are. Wonderful. Thank you. So you're going to tell us about how we're seeing faith communities advocating for global climate action, for climate action globally. And you're going to give us some examples of faith from faith communities and faith leaders across the country, across the world. So thank you, Rachel. Over to you.
Thank you so much, Giles, and good afternoon, Greenbelt. It's wonderful to be with you this afternoon. I'm going to share with you three different stories. So this first picture is of the Delta Basin of the Okavango in Namibia and Botswana. It's one of the seven wonders of the world. At the end of 2020, the Bishop of Namibia, Luke Pato, woke up to the news that a Canadian oil company, Recon Africa, had been given rights to explore 35,000 square kilometers, and exploratory drilling had already begun. This was devastating because of the potential contamination of water reaching the Okavango, the impact on local indigenous communities, and the pollution of water in Namibia, which is one of the driest countries in Africa. How did the church respond? So we contacted bishops across Southern Africa and bishops in Canada, and we prepared a petition, which was signed by 34 bishops and three archbishops, which was to go to the Namibian embassy in Cape Town. At the same time, we reached out to interfaith friends in Canada, Kairos, Canada, and they took the petition to the Recon Africa headquarters in Vancouver. Now, that's where things became very interesting, because the newspaper that had broken the story in Namibia was threatened with being sued by Recon Africa. And so the media turned to the story of the bishops, because they could write stories about the bishops without getting sued. So the stories that came out were Anglican bishops declare drilling in the Kavango a sin. A couple of days later, the National Geographic wrote a story on the Recon Africa drilling. A few days later, Leonardo DiCaprio tweeted about it, and the cat was definitely out of the bag. The communities continue to mobilize. There continues to be international pressure, but everything is now being seen and is out in the open. The next story I would like to share, I'd like to show you this picture of the Wild Coast in South Africa. Now, Shell in 2021 proposed to conduct seismic blasting off the Wild Coast of South Africa. This is a very biodiverse and ecologically sensitive area. It's known for its rich marine life, and it is a migratory route for whales and dolphins. Now, seismic blasting involves using air guns to send powerful sound waves through the ocean to map the seabed for oil and gas deposits. These sound waves can be very painful and harmful to marine life, particularly whales and dolphins and sea creatures that rely on echolocation. It disrupts their communication and even their feeding patterns. So the church joined an unprecedented wave of opposition from environmental groups, local communities, and indigenous groups. We raised concerns about the potential impact on marine ecosystems and local livelihoods, which depend heavily on fishing and tourism. Churches encouraged silent protests and a boycott of Shell garages. And then a chain of 35 garages called Express Petroleum along the coast debranded from Shell and changed companies because of the public protests and the pressure from customers who saw that they were linked with Shell and horror at the impact of the possible seismic blasting on the West Coast. Several NGOs branded together and won a court case based on the impact on marine life, the impact on the local communities and particularly the fishing community, and the spiritual significance of the Wild Coast. That court case was successful, but unfortunately now Shell are moving up to Namibia and looking to do the same off the Namibian coast. The third story is in northern Mozambique, an area called Cabo Delgado. Now, Cabo Delgado is one of the poorest areas on the planet, and people survive by fishing and by smallholder farming. Total started a massive gas plant, which led to the displacement of local people. Now, young people, particularly men who were unable to fish or to access their farms, joined a terror organization called El Shabab so that they could fight back. Attacks started on oil workers and spread to government officials such as teachers. This led to a wave of terror, and there were many cases where people were murdered and decapitated and the bodies left without the heads to terrorize the communities. People fled in the hundreds of thousands, and about 500,000 people have been displaced. This led to a humanitarian disaster. What was the role of the church? Apart from being heavily involved in humanitarian support, the Bishop of Nampula, Bishop Ernesto Manuel, spoke about the situation to the BBC and was able to bring the voice of the local community in contrast to the messages that Total was giving. Secondly, he was able to get his story told at a side event at COP. There are strong links between Mozambique and the Diocese of London, and the story of Cabo Delgado was one of the motivations which ultimately led to the Diocese of London divesting from fossil fuels. The Anglican Church in Southern Africa, because of what happened in Namibia and in Mozambique, passed a resolution standing against any new fossil fuel projects across Southern Africa. And last year, we were able to bring this up to the Anglican Communion at the Anglican Consultative Council, and we passed a resolution in support of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I'd like to end by encouraging everybody to take part in the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is a call to halt new gas and oil projects. Globally, there are more than 400 projects which we call carbon bombs, massive projects which are in the pipeline and which can still be stopped. These are projects that exceed 1 gigaton of carbon dioxide in their lifetime. Look at the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. Sign it, discuss it with your church, with your school, with your university, with your municipality. And let us have a wave of people who are saying, let us stop these new fossil fuel projects. We can use our banks. Many of our banks are funding these new projects. And as churches, we can pull our money out. It's important that we remember that these carbon bomb projects are not only climate change bombs. They are also causing incredible environmental degradation, and they are trampling on the human rights of the local communities. In the words of Archbishop Tutu, climate change is the human rights issue of our time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for those three very inspiring stories, showing how kind of high-level action can work with local communities and how the faith groups can work with other groups in order to bring about really essential change. Now, Kamran is going to tell us a bit about your work with local communities and how people on the grassroots, people on the ground, are making a difference. Kamran, over to you.
Thank you, Giles, and thank you, everybody, for having me. I'm Kamran Shahzad. I'm from the Bahu Trust, and I'm also the director for the Islamic Foundation for Ecology and Environmental Sciences. Historically, I've done lots of work within the Muslim community, but since I got to know Faith for the Climate, I've been quite heavily involved in working with the other minority communities, specifically the Sikh community, the Hindu community, and the Buddhist community on climate action. And during that time, I've gained a lot of experience myself around how to work on climate change issues. And so my next part is going to be around how do we talk about climate change and how do we engage in climate action with their respective communities. And it was spoken about in the last session, and it was a question that came up quite often. And I find lots of church groups or secular environmental organizations come to me and say, Kamran, how do we reach out to a mosque or to a gurdwara or to a mandir or to a community group? It feels as if we can't get through to them. when we're talking about these things. So I'm just going to give everybody five tips on if you want to engage with your local communities, how do you talk to them on climate action? Okay, the first one is ask questions. And it's always important to remember that the person you're talking to or who you want to engage on climate action may not have the same values as you. They may have a completely different viewpoint on things. And if you're going to have a constructive conversation with them, don't do it in a patronizing way. And even if you're going to ask questions, be genuinely interested in what they have to say. I've seen too many conversations where it comes across as A, preaching to B. And that's what we want to avoid. By asking questions, you're allowing people to answer. And quite often, sometimes when you get asked a question, you realize yourself you don't always know the answer. And it gets you thinking about what you thought you knew or what you don't know. But when you ask questions, avoid asking why all the time. Because again, that comes across as patronizing. Do it in a way where you're asking solutions from people. Okay, number two, reframe the issue. Okay, again, something which may be climate action to you may not be climate action to somebody else. And Shannon gave a very good example of this earlier of a friend of his. Quite often the issues of climate change are impacting people quite significantly. But when you talk about climate change, it goes way over people's head. In my mosque, for instance, if I try to ban the eating of meat, it's World War III. And then if I talk about climate change as a reason, it's even bigger fight. So what we do is we talk about food and healthy lifestyle and the health inequalities that are in our community and how the type of food they're eating, especially red meat, impacts their health. And you will find people slowly start to understand the issues. So reframing, same with around air pollution. Air pollution, I carry an inhaler with me all the time. My son now, all three of my children are now asthmatic too, just because of where they live. So when you talk to parents, again, climate change seems so distant. Pick a particular topic that impacts them in that area. It could be transport, it could be food, it could be health, it could be energy. Energy is a huge issue right now. Number three, stories and narratives. Stories are so important. Again, from a mosque perspective, I'm sure it's the same in the church. Okay. When you start quoting verses from the Bible or from the Quran, it goes in one ear, comes out the other. Yeah, am I right? And it's the same with Muslims. It's the same with other faiths. If you give people stories, whether they're biblical stories or historical stories or stories in your own life, people very quickly start sharing stories with you in return. And then what you've done is you've empowered them to learn more about climate-related issues. Number four, know your stuff and your audience. Again, facts are very important. Make sure when you're talking to people about climate-related matters that you know exactly what you're talking about. Don't try to throw everything into one pot. And know your audience. This, I think, is something many people don't get correct. Or what they do is they think everyone is on the same level. But even in there's no such thing as a community within communities. They are communities. How you talk to a Muslim person is very different to how you talk to a Hindu person, and that's very different to how you talk to a Sikh person, and so on. So, but even within that, how you talk to someone who speaks Urdu is different to how you speak to somebody who speaks Punjabi, to how somebody speaks Mirpuri. They have different cultures. And then there's also communities of postcode and geography. You know, that's very important. And finally, stay calm. I've seen too many people get over agitated about the world is going to come to an end in 6 years, and they start saying, oh, but why aren't you changing? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? And you'll quite often lose people. Is that in your conversation, be part of the solution with the people you are trying to change. Thank you very much. That was 2 minutes.
That was perfect. Sean, thanks so much. Thank you, Kamran. So you've brought it really down to ground level. And I think all those principles you could use in any kind of action, but particularly in something as challenging as action over the climate. And if any of you are activists, and I know some of you are, in climate, you know how exhausting it can be sometimes and overwhelming when we face the problems which we're facing. So, Rachel, let me ask you, what can people of faith do to balance the urgency and the enormity of the crisis without becoming overwhelmed or depressed or stuck?
I think the first thing I would say is follow your heartbreak. There are so many issues and we can't be involved in all of them. We can't be climate activists and endangered species activists and plastic activists and polluted air activists and all these issues in one go. So find the issue that when you read about it, when you listen to it, breaks your heart, because that is where the Spirit of God is moving in your life. And when you've identified that thing that gives you that connects with your soul and your heart and your passion, find other people who are like-minded so that you're not working on your own. You meet the most amazing people on this planet, and some of them on your stage through working in environmental justice space. And it is amazing to be part of a movement and to find people have similar passions to you. The second thing I would say is I always say you can't change the world, but you can make a world of difference in one area. So what God has put on my heart is to make a difference in the Anglican Church. Maybe you are called to make a difference in your university, or you're made called to make a difference in your church or in your mosque or in your street or where you are. So you can make a world of difference if we cut it into small pieces. Somebody else has to deal with other parts, but you make a world of difference where you are. And otherwise, if you think about the whole world, you're going to become very depressed. And then I think the third thing is to identify what feeds your soul. You know, we are blessed in that we are working for care for creation, for the environment. So we're all people who love God's creation. So consciously find times and spaces where you can be filled up again. If it's being on the ocean or climbing on the mountain, that has to be part of your balance. So do the things that give you energy. For most people, it's getting exercise, it's your times of prayer or meditation, and it's making sure that you eat healthy food that helps you to keep balanced. But make time to be in nature and to be fed by God's creation, as well as working to save it.
That's so helpful. Thank you so much, Rachel. And thinking about making a difference, I know I can vouch for the difference that you've made within the Anglican Communion. So many, many thanks for that. The other thing I often think about is that it's about doing your best, isn't it? And sometimes I think, you know, if we look back in the future, we find even if it hasn't all worked, we'll know that we did our best. And there's something about bringing ourselves to everything that we do, which makes such a difference to us and can also help to nourish us. Shannon, we're hearing about the way in which people are coming together from different faith communities. So what advice would you give to people who are keen to make connections with other local faith communities on climate?
This is less advice than it is insights and analysis that I've gained in my role as director of something like Faith for the Climate. So what I've learned is that, because this is not the sector I come from, you know, back in Malaysia, I was doing more social justice, human rights work. I was working on detention without trial, refugees, asylum seekers, gender, sexuality. And I've moved into climate work, having worked in the human rights and social justice sector. But just seeing how the landscape is structured in the UK, religion is managed in a particular way in this country, and interfaith relations are managed in a particular way. And they are very often led by very well-meaning Protestant churches, which means that interfaith work takes a very Protestantized Western Christian flavor. And so there's a kind of Anglican logic of, okay, we've got our parish church, we've got our vicar. So what's the Muslim version of a parish church? What's the Muslim version of a vicar? What's the Muslim version of a Sikh place of worship? What's the Muslim version of a Christian version? Sorry, an Anglican version of a Sikh vicar. So it's a very Anglican model of thinking, how do we get all these people and structures together? And I think this creates gatekeepers and community leaders, and it sort of serves the purposes of the state. It makes interfaith relations easy to manage. And when things don't go according to plan, these interfaith networks get threatened. So you might all have heard of something called the Interfaith Network, which was doing very, very important work on interfaith relations in the UK. It doesn't exist anymore because they decided that they were going to appoint a trustee who was part of the Muslim Council of Britain, and the previous government, the Conservative government, was trying to cut all its relationships with the Muslim Council of Britain because they were not the right type of Muslims. And because of that, the Interfaith Network has effectively shut down and ceased operations. And I think that's a terrible thing. Now, how do we work with this as Faith for the Climate? We try not to be an organization that creates these sorts of equivalences between different faith groups. At Faith for the Climate, I think if you come and you say you're a person of faith, you speak for yourself. There's no Christians say X, Y, and Z about climate. It's more like, this is me, I'm a Christian of my particular denomination or whatever. This is how I understand climate. I'm a Muslim, this is how I understand. This is what Islam tells me. I'm not speaking for all Muslims, but this is how Islam informs my climate and environmental activism. And I think that that's a much more productive way of working, and that's a much more effective way of looking for people within your local networks, because then they don't just appear in mosques, synagogues, gurdwaras, or churches. You might go anywhere. There might be a local Kaylee that you attend. You know, Giles's church is famous for organizing Kaylees. There was a Bollywood Kaylee a couple of years ago. And there you might meet people who, because they've heard of St. John's Church and the work that it does, but they want to have an enjoyable night out, they come to the Kaylee. They suddenly learn that, oh, but this is a church that's doing climate work as well. I'm interested in climate. It's a lot more spontaneous, and sometimes it doesn't go anywhere, but it's a much more rewarding way of forming relationships with people. So that picnic that I showed you before, that was actually a collaboration between many, many different organizations that had not worked together in this way before. You know, there was a Shia Sufi organization, there was Islamic Relief UK, there were the Ahmadi Muslims, there were the Quakers, there were the Buddhists, there was the Church of England, a few Roman Catholics got involved, Eco-Judaism got involved. They all came together to do something together, because it was a picnic, because they found that it was fun, and it was a collaboration with Giles's congregation. And I said before that the climate movement is probably the second least diverse sector in the UK, and it's notoriously lacking in representation from people of African or Caribbean descent. But guess what? They showed up to this picnic. Why? Because they are members of Giles's congregation, and we have formed relationships with them. We know what makes them tick, and we don't sort of dumb down the climate discussion with them. Because if you talk to, you know, Giles's church warden originally comes from Jamaica. She's not a climate activist. But when you talk to her about loss and damage and fossil fuels and climate disasters, she's like, I know, because this is what my family is going through in Jamaica, yeah. Right? So you're doing this picnic, I am there. I'm helping. I am doing the dishes for you. I'm setting out the tables for you. I might not be able to speak about climate, but I am there. So there were members of the Ugandan congregation, the West African congregation from Giles' church who turned up. And I think that's why they turned up, because we formed those organic relationships rather than looking to see, well, who's the Ugandan climate person? It's more organic. It's a lot more work, but I find it a lot more rewarding as well.
Thank you, Shannon, so much. It's about building relationships. It's also about joy, isn't it? We've heard quite a lot about joy over the past couple of weeks coming out from the Democratic Congress in America. And there is something about combining the crisis which we're facing with reflection of the fact that we are all loved by God and that joy is at the heart of that relationship. So many thanks for reminding us of that with the picnic and the ceilidh. Cameron, we're hearing increasingly the impact of climate change around the world. Certainly locally, I mean, we talk about climate in this strange summer that we're having. But these climates have been seen by our sisters and brothers globally for much longer. And how can we help faith communities to make a connection between climate breakdown in the UK and the even more extreme impacts that are being seen around the world?
Thank you. I think climate-related issues are a lot more accessible in places of worship now than they were a few years ago. Many different reasons for that. Whether it's the COPs that have been highlighted, mediates the various interfaith networks that are doing work, even David Attenborough, I think, and the BBC programmes have made it more open and accessible. There is a huge difference between communities and faith and faith establishments, and quite something I realised during COP26 when we were in Glasgow is that there's a huge gap, that communities of faith who quite often want to do things, their faith establishments are not giving them the platform. And I think there's a lot more that places of worship can do. Yeah. And I'm going to focus on that in particular because they hold power. And I think climate activists need access to that. And there are good examples of where that's happening. Your church, for instance, the Bahu Trust, is other places around. The first obvious action is good old-fashioned sermons, khutbas, Sunday schools, supplementary schools, and madrasas need to be talking about these issues a lot more. Bearing in mind that places of worship are already having to talk about so many issues that are going out. Times are not easy. There's a huge array of difficulties that our communities are facing. However, there are other spaces that our places of worship can open. You know, we have plenty of rooms. We can give access to activists or young people to take ownership of rooms and hold their own events without being, you know, letting their governance take over too much. I also think places of worship need to be involved in activism.
Yeah.
It's easier for some faith groups than it is for others. But if you do it well, it can be done. And we've seen in the various global issues how our activism can be strengthened if you're doing it together. And I suppose that's my next point. Joining forces with both other faith groups and with secular groups, it's so important to work together. And finally, I would say, I think it's important for faith groups to work with local authorities.
Yeah.
Because influencing policy is so important. We shouldn't just be working on behavior change. Behavior change is about our relation between, it's more about God consciousness, I believe. It's a relationship between us and God. But policy change is a societal change. And you're only going to do that if you influence your local council to do things differently or the government. And I can guarantee you, if you have a busy place of worship, your local council will listen to you because they're afraid of your numbers.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that, Cameron. Absolutely. And really important to bring in the local authorities because they are key players. Wherever you are in the country and across the world, local authorities are the people who can often make a real difference. So very quickly now, because I do want to open it up for questions, but before we do, can I ask each of you, quickly, we've got COP29, I think, coming up in Azerbaijan very soon. We've got COP30 in Brazil next year. How can we ensure that faith communities have a real voice in these big international moments, which, as we all know, don't do what we want to achieve always, but do sometimes move things forward? So, Rachel, how do you think we can make sure that faith communities have a voice in this?
I don't think we can make sure faith communities have a voice. I think the UNFCCC process and the COP process have been taken over by the fossil fuel lobbyists. So I don't think we can have a big voice at these meetings. I think what we can do is we can use those meetings as an opportunity to educate society. I mean, I think you guys saw that in Glasgow, that because COP was in the news, that people were educated, they were more interested in it. We saw that when we had COP here in Durban in South Africa, there was a lot of interest. The COP, which is taking place in Brazil, the Anglican Church of Brazil is already mobilizing. So there will be some people from, for example, from the Anglican Communion who will attend. But we're looking at their role as they attend, not that they're particularly going to be able to influence the outcomes, but that they can use the experience of being at COP to educate, right. For example, on the issue of loss and damage. One has seen that there's been a shift there. How do we bring the real stories of loss and damage into people's consciousness? So I think faith communities can take the opportunity of that gathering of many thousands of people, many fossil fuel lobbyists who come together as well, and not despair, but to also use that as a time to educate people. But I don't have great hopes for any of the upcoming COPs.
Thank you very much indeed. No, I think I share your realism. But you also mentioned the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that's certainly coming increasingly.
That is a much,
well.
What gives me hope is the court cases, which are coming more and more and more. The court cases are really important, and they can make a big difference. People get pulling their money out of fossil fuel projects and the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, because countries like Colombia, which is an oil-producing country, are signing up onto that treaty. And I think that gives me a lot more hope than the UNFCCC process or the COP process.
Amen to that. Thank you so much. Kamran, quick thoughts on this?
I partly echo what Rachel has just said. It does become quite difficult to have confidence in the COP processes, but it's the only major process we have, but it needs to be reformed. However, I do think we shouldn't just be focusing on the UNFCCC. There's many other COPs that take place. So you've got the COP16, the Biodiversity COP. We have United Nations Environment Assembly on pollution and other matters, which Rachel's quite heavily involved in. But it's also important that we're focused on the COPs of other UN agencies that are not, we don't necessarily see as environmentally focused, such as WHO or UN Habitat, which is about sustainable cities. What I do see, which is my criticism of faith groups, is that they always tend to be at the UNFCCC COPs. And I think we need to figure out how we can be at the other COPs so we're having a wider impact in different spaces. Thank you.
That's a big challenge, but a really, really helpful one. Thank you. Shannon, what are your thoughts?
Now, with these international negotiations, the primary, you know, unit of the voice that gets represented is the voice of the nation state, right? But it's represented by particular governments, particular negotiators, and so on. So it's very nation state specific, which of course gets undermined by all the fossil fuel companies. There's corporate capture basically of these international negotiations. I think what faith groups do is they sort of break this nationalism. They have the potential to. Because if we think about faith communities, they are quintessentially local, embedded in local communities with actual lived experiences of climate injustice, environmental injustice, but they are also quintessentially transnational. So faiths cross borders. And if you are a Christian in this country, you will see from a particular denomination, you will see how climate breakdown is affecting members of your own denomination somewhere else in the world. And these churches are connected to each other. If we can find a way for faith groups to work together locally different faith groups as well as across borders. This is such an effective way to reframe the discussion anytime an international negotiation happens and it's being blocked or stymied by some corporate lobby, some powerful nation state. This is how faith communities can have the potential to change the debate. Because also when we enter the discussion, we might not be technical experts. I'm no scientific expert on climate. I'm not an economic expert. I'm not a policy expert. I do this because I believe the climate crisis is a moral and spiritual injustice, and it requires moral and spiritual solutions. And that's what we need. That's what the framework is for us to get through this together, right? So this is how we can disrupt the debate. As everyone has said, this doesn't always happen, but that's the potential. And I think the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty is actually a good way in because it doesn't just focus on nation states signing up to it. Subnational jurisdictions can sign up to it as well. Your local council can sign up. The City of London has signed up. California has signed up to it. So any subnational jurisdiction. And once we do this all around the world, we can show that actually the majority of the world supports this treaty, even if particular nation states are laggards when it comes to it. So I hope that we'll all take this on as well.
Thank you very much, Shannon. So there's something about being subversive, isn't there, as well? Something both about joy and about subversion as we try to change the way the world works. We've got a few minutes left now for questions. So I think we'll take two questions from the audience to start with. So are there any hands, any questions, or have we silenced you all? Or any comments? There's a comment here. Question.
Hi, thank you for that discussion, really helpful. I work for the Just Money movement. One of the things we try and do is tell a different story about how our economy can operate from kind of Christian biblical principles. And a lot of that story is about kind of how we relate to earth and how we relate to one another. I'd just love to hear kind of from the interfaith perspective, both examples of how other faiths are maybe framing that different story of how we can exist and how we can be in the world. And also any like advice, guidance, tips you might have for how we bring those stories together, have that conversation together in a way that acknowledges all those different stories and is able to kind of make them more powerful.
Thank you so much. That's such an interesting question. We could spend another 2 hours on that, I think. But Shannon, let's come to you first. Different stories and how we can combine them to make the whole greater than the sum of the parts.
Okay, I'm thinking on my feet here, but you were there at the picnic as well. So, and people loved your stall, not just the members of the church, but everyone else who spoke to you. I think it's not so much the different story. Sometimes it's the same story, but it's using different concepts, different spiritual concepts, different anchoring points to tell that same story. I think the commonality that I find, and this is why I think it's important for faith groups to talk about climate and environmental justice as well, is because when this, so, you know, when we think about social justice movements, we think of the secular political left. That's their natural home. And at Faith for the Climate, like, we agree with their analysis. Like, there's nothing to argue about with the political analysis. But sometimes it's how it's said, the kind of language that's used, sometimes the tone that the message takes. So there are sometimes, you know, things that come from some of the very, you know, political left movements that I have to retranslate for a Faith for the Climate audience, because it either sounds too angry, it sounds too confrontational, it sounds like it has no soul sometimes. I mean, that's a terrible thing to say. If anyone here belongs to any of those movements, that's not meant as a read, but you know, that just happens, and yeah, we just have to find ways to put some soul into it. And I think that's what lots of the faith groups at Faith for the Climate are trying to do in their own way.
Soul, absolutely. Rachel, what's your thoughts on that?
I didn't quite catch what the question was, but was it about reframing the stories?
It was about the way in which different people, different traditions have different stories, and it's how we can kind of combine them in order to make the whole, Not by kind of denying the diversity, but how we can make it creative, I think.
Because I think one of the things that faith communities in their diversity from the different religions, when we come together, the one thing that does unite us is bringing hope. And I think the environmental movement desperately needs hope at the moment. Young people are faced with eco-anxiety, people are saying they don't want to have children because the future looks so bleak. And we have these constant negative stories, which actually, it often paralyzes you when you're constantly getting negative stories. You feel like your small efforts are hopeless.
Yeah.
And I like the last year's season of creation's theme was the river of justice. And for me, I find that a really helpful image because my small action as an individual is like a drop of rain that comes together into a small stream, which might be your parish green team. Then it comes into a river, which is maybe like the Arosha Eco Church movement. Then that comes together with the Eco Jewish movement. It comes together with the Bahu Trust. It comes together with, so these different streams then come together. Yeah. And when the streams come together and they make a river, then you get a mighty river of justice. And it's the mighty river of justice that is able to move mountains.
Flowing down like an ever-rolling stream. Thank you, Rachel. And Cameron, I'm going to give you the last word.
Probably not the best last word, so we'll... sometimes I always also find that we don't always need to combine stories. Sometimes we try to talk to everybody, we end up talking to nobody. That it's okay sometimes to just focus on our own communities. Because as a Muslim, I know I have lots of work to do within my own Muslim community. So I don't want to be spending lots of time in an interfaith gathering because I know I have a huge audience that I really have to change their mindset. So it's knowing individually who your communities are and then knowing when to combine it. At what point do you combine? Who do you bring around to the table? That's really my message. It's knowing that audience.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things I've learned from all of this work across different faith traditions is the celebration of diversity and the celebration of difference. You know, that's what makes us human, is our difference. There's a kind of generosity around it at best, kind of generous faith, if you like. I've just written a book called Generous Faith, by the way, which you can buy from the bookshop. So I just want to say thank you very, very much to our panelists. Thank you, Rachel, for joining us from South Africa. Thank you, Cameron. And thank you, Shannon. So...
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.